Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's only bloody Nish Kumar, isn't it?
It's only bloody Aaron Jones, isn't it?
Oh, hello, mate. How are you doing?
How you doing? What's going on? Yeah, very good.
What I always like, this is quite an odd thing to say, and I'll probably regret saying it, but I don't know where I'm going with this. Some people just have a very pleasing face in the sense that I feel more positive about the world. You've got kind of a chirpy, you give good vibes.
I've got quite a chirpy demeanor. I think that is correct. That is something that has been noted about me. It's my sort of somewhat sunny disposition. But yeah, I'm in a pretty good mood. I'm on tour at the moment, but I'm on a stretch where I'm able to come home at the end of gigs. And so I think maybe that's what you're feeling. Maybe if I was in a hotel room, the energy might be a bit staler. But as it is,
Alan Partridge style traveling.
Alan Partridge, it's like a sort of, it's funny to people who don't spend a lot of time in hotels, but to people who do spend time in hotels, it's a Michael Haneke slice of dark social realism. That series when he's living in the travel tavern, you're like, yeah, I've been there.
We've all done it.
We've all had our stretches.
I'm going to ask you, what I'm going to do about your tour is probably like insert planted questions maybe like Fine. Three times throughout. So Perfect. Before, where are you touring just at the moment? Just out of interest. Nish Kumar's tour, by the way, everyone.
This is a run of gigs that I'm doing. So as we record, I'll be in Gravesend tonight.
Love Gravesend.
To quote Kima Bob, my support act, who is American, why are all your place names so scary? And then I'll do Hackney Friday and Saturday, and then Tunbridge Wells. And then, you know, it just sort of rolls on and on. I'm happy to be doing it, but it's been extended artificially by me getting COVID for a week and us having to reschedule a bunch of gigs.
Oh, this is because you do, I'm not going to say you sound a bit COVID-y, but you do, there's a COVID.
This is not COVID, my friend. This is what's called, you're talking to me at 9 a.m.
Yeah, I was going to say.
This is what's called, Owen, I woke up 15 minutes ago.
I did drag Nish out of bed to do this at 9 a.m. because I'm going to Edinburgh. I'm sorry, he's got to work around my schedule as it turns out.
It's so funny because this is the second time this has happened this week. And somebody talked to me being like, are you ill?
No,
it's just the morning.
It's just 9:09 a.m. Yeah. It's just, I was going to say, it sounds a little Ronery. I was deltaed. I got a delta at a gay rave. I don't deserve any sympathy for that. This is what happened. I'll just be honest about it.
Right.
The gays at it again.
But that's just like, at least you got it from like a sort of fun reason. I think I got it. I think I got Omicron via either my friend's book event, which is fine because we did go to a very small, like we did go to, I guess, like a bar that is basically a coronavirus distribution center. Like it really was very small. And also the same week, my partner attended a wedding that it transpired was a super spreader event. So yeah. It's like, it was one of those things. I kept texting my friend saying the net is closing on me because I was touring, I was going out, I was sort of engaging with the world. And it was just at that point about a month ago where it just felt like everyone was getting it. And I woke up. It was the worst possible version of it because we're like, the one thing we don't want to happen, we all know we're probably going to get COVID. Everybody's triple vaxxed. It's coming for us. We're on tour. We're out in the world. The one thing we don't want to have happen is for you to get it when you're in Aberdeen, because then we would have to transport you back. So that's exactly what happened. I woke up in Aberdeen and I was like, I've got COVID 100%. Even before I knew the test, I was like, I can see that red line. Yeah. And I did the test. I mean, this is probably too much information. I did the test, went to take a shit, came back from the shit, the double red line. And then my tour manager, my support act was my friend Tessa Coates, who had had every possible variation of COVID. I think she's, at this point, her blood is basically the vaccine because she's had them all. So she was just like, okay, I'm fine. It'll be great. I had it within the last 2 months, so that's not a problem. And then my tour manager had not had Omicron, and she basically had to green book me back from Aberdeen with me like sat in the back seat with my face all heavily strapped up like Hannibal Lecter. And it was a 15-hour drive.
Oh my God.
With just like me strapped in the back. But otherwise, listen, otherwise it was absolute candy ass post-triple vax Rona. It was a heavy head cold.
I don't get it though. That's your first time.
Yeah.
It is.
And
I just find
that furious.
Absolute. Well, I'm furious that you didn't get it. Yeah, I get a bit. I'm actually getting to the point where if someone hasn't got COVID, I'm kind of irritated with them. But I find that. I just kind of, they're just flawed. I mean, it's irritating behavior. It's just, I mean, we're over 2 years in now. What are you doing? How have you avoided it? It's suspicious. But I don't understand how you got away with it.
I think there's like a South Korean scientist who I think has withdrawn these comments, but I think he did say, if you haven't had COVID by now, you have no friends.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be.
How many times have you had it?
I think I only had it. Well, actually, I'm not going to bore you with the details of this, but I'm still because a lot of people say this, and I think a lot of people just roll their eyes instinctively because they think it's a load of nonsense. But I really do think I might have got it in January 2020.
Right. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Because I got. So, I don't get ill. I mean, I genuinely just don't get ill. Last time I was ill before that, I was six.
Yeah.
That,
right.
That was a horrible time. But I got it, and I suddenly came down with like respiratory infection, really labored breathing, really bad fever, night sweats, including really weird dreams where I was chased by Nicola Sturgeon, who turned into a zombie. So that was a symptom, apparently. Anyway, and then I went to the doctors and they were like, have you gone to Wuhan? I was like, oh, no. And then they were like, my breathing was so labored, they had to give me an inhaler. Then I started to get better, then it hit me again. That sounds a bit COVID-y.
Yeah, it sounds like you had COVID. Oh, so, Christ, I mean, you know what? The last thing you need is to turn out that you were the person that brought COVID to the UK. That's the only way. The only way you or I could be more disliked than we are is if it turned out one of us was the
patient zero.
Patient zero in the UK. Rabid leftist Owen Jones.
Yeah, gleefully spreads the Rona. And I actually think then, because I knew lots of people in Westminster, I hung out with them. So actually, you can see then how it spread throughout West. And then, I mean, you can see how I could get in a lot of trouble if we pursue this.
Owen Jones attempts to assassinate Boris Johnson by giving him COVID via 15 different people.
We just need to, I'm just saying, let's just keep this to a minimum because some people are going to run with this now. Some people will run with this. So, right, you're talking
leftist
now.
Leftist quote-unquote comedian Nish Kumar laughed hysterically.
Objectively, you did. So those facts aren't gonna. They don't need to twist that one.
It'd be the truest thing that's ever been printed about me in the Daily Express.
The Daily Express is weird, by the way. Because do you have this as well? If I go on like a TV show, Jeremy Vine or whatever, and I say something, and Jeremy Vine go, "Well, is that true, though, Owen?" And then the Daily Express headline would be, "Owen Jones destroyed in humiliating." Does that happen when you do anything? Do they do the same thing?
Yeah, but you know, like. It's even weirder with me because once it happened during Sunday brunch, very lighthearted chat show. Rick Edwards and I, who are friends, had a sort of mock dispute about something. And it was, and during the ad break, Rick just turned to me and went, "Have you seen this?" And he showed me his phone. And the Daily Express had run an article saying, like, fury on Sunday brunch as Edwards and Kumar clash.
I love it. They do it within minutes. They're there, obviously. They've got someone watching every channel, and then like, bam, in you go.
If it was a real journalist, I apologise for impugning them, but it read like it was assembled by a bot. Like, I think it's all like bot assembly. It really is like if a human wrote that, they should not have a career in journalism. It was astonishing.
I think that's what they do, because I remember looking at one where I was just like, this is so ludicrous.
Yeah.
And I looked at them up, and you'd read it thinking someone to the right of Genghis Khan had written it. But I looked them up, and they were like some aspiring journalist who was actually quite left-wing.
That happens, doesn't it, with all those papers. The Mail and the Express are full of like 25-year-olds who are just trying to pay their rent.
It's degrading. Nish, you're on tour now. I keep saying this, but the reason I'm saying that isn't just to just crowbar it in because it's nice if everyone goes and watches you on tour. But that is nice. But obviously, we have this pandemic. I don't know if we've obviously noticed that. But
what?
What happened there?
Hell, I made a television show in this room I'm in because I wanted to.
Yeah, just for
just for a laugh.
Obviously, you couldn't tour during that, so that was terrible. So, I mean, you know, I mean, how was your pandemic, obviously, apart from not getting COVID, which is kind of irritating?
Yeah, my pandemic.
I mean, now you can tour.
Yeah, it's definitely a relief to be able to, because when you start in comedy, you know, the sort of the grandees, you Stuart Lees, will give you a long talk saying, make sure you always keep your live work up, because television and radio, you're at the whims of commissioners. And they're correct, like anything could happen in your career. But as long as you keep your hand in with the live work, as long as you keep your sort of live work up, it'll be fine. And then in March 2020, everyone was like, oh, maybe we're completely fucked. And I didn't ask if I could swear. I assume this is on the internet, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we'll just presume that's, just take that as read, that's fine.
You're absolutely cunted, Owen. You know, this is the thing. When March 2020, we were all just like... But I was very lucky because I was about to start work on a TV series. And so I kind of went in at the start. I mean, I was lucky, like, professionally. But I think I was also, like, lucky in terms of my, like, personal mental health, because I sort of had something to busy myself with for the first 6 weeks. Like, that first wave was really... mad, like, you know, nobody understood what was going on, we didn't know what was going to happen, and I think from an existential perspective it was very nice for me to have like a little television show to worry about and sort of spend all my time thinking, oh, how are we going to make a comedy show out of this, rather than actually grappling with the fact that the air was full of disease.
So obviously the Mash Report, people are now, people are very excited, obviously, I'm talking to you, and people want to ask about the Mash Report and what happened to the Mash Report, which is obviously a great bit of television. So David Bowerwater wants to know what the difference is between the BBC and Dave was, because obviously it went over to Dave with the Mash Report, and to ask about, I suppose, the constraints the BBC might have put on it, or did you face constraints, and were the Tories involved with this show getting the axe? Because they don't want to know the truth.
Yeah, I know. They a mildly left-wing show must be removed from television, otherwise the government will fall. I don't know what happened. I know that we were told that they'd run out of money, and we sort of said, okay, that's fine. It's not beyond the realms of possibility to believe that the BBC would run out of money. And we did four series. It's pretty good. But then there was just this weird Sun article that then happened in February 2021, where they said that sources close to the director general said that he had personally got rid of it. And the thing that got very strange was I got a private email from someone that said, at the BBC, that said, ignore it, this is absolute nonsense, don't engage with it. And I sort of did say to them, it would be useful if someone said something publicly. And just then, since then, I never heard anything back. And we never heard anything back about it. And so I don't really know what to make of that. It's all a bit strange. I will say this for The Sun, and this will be the one and only time I praise them in my entire life. The headline for that article was Nish Mash Bosh. And you know what? Fair enough.
It's just a solid
piece of wordplay.
Because you know when they came up with that headline, how happy that person was.
Someone gave themselves a day off with a full boner. Like, it was like somebody really had a good day. But yeah, that was basically my perception. That's all I understand of it. And you know, I've done a few interviews where I've mentioned it. The interviewers have asked the BBC for comment, and they've offered no comment. But I think, you know, I do just think. I think it's a sort of strange. It's been a strange couple of years to work at the BBC, an organisation that I absolutely love and will defend forever. But it's just, I don't think any organisation operates in a reasonable and healthy way when it has a gun pointed directly at its head. And you know, I think that this is the end result of years and years of pressure from successive Conservative governments. You know, I think the moment George Osborne, and this is the thing, like, this is the thing that even at the time people tried to explain, but it was sort of, it's an example of the kind of sophisticated cruelty of Osborne and Cameron and their project to sort of, dismantled the British state, because Osborne changed the rule, shifted the responsibility to the BBC to pay for the over 75 licence fees. And that was a way in which they were able to essentially cut the BBC's funding without actually... Because it is interesting with the British public, because in the abstract, everybody moans about the BBC all the time. But when they actually talk about getting rid of the licence fee, that then everyone gets a little bit tense. And I think probably what the BBC did in the pandemic has probably illustrated its social utility, you know, in terms of providing resources for homeschooling. It was an example of how smart Osborne was in executing his unpleasantness, because it meant that the BBC was forced into a position whereby it lay a time bomb under the corporation. So then when that went off, they were able to essentially report that the BBC is refusing to pay over 75 licence fees. But actually it was a decision made by George Osborne, who then immediately swanned off it to, you know, edit the Evening Standard, a position he, from what I can tell, had absolutely no qualifications to do. And
it thrived.
Under the reassuringly steady stewardship of gorgeous George, it thrived. But yeah,
he's my least favourite of them all, actually. But anyway, it's a conversation.
I do feel a deep well of anger to David Cameron and George Osborne, because I think that the sort of slight chaos that followed. It's a bit like it's a bit like the Republican Party from when we were kids, you know, at the kind of turn of the millennium and at the start of the Iraq War, you know, you believed that Bush and Cheney were the devil and the devil's dumber friend who wore a cowboy hat all the time. But like, you know, then there was an attempt to essentially, you know, reappraise that Bush and Cheney. That I always really liked the Adam McKay film Vice, because I think that it was, and I know I have friends of mine who politically would be completely in line with me, but who found the film almost too angry. But I really liked it because I thought it was a really important bit of, I thought it was really important to remind people that the Bush and Cheney era was an absolute nightmare, and in many ways sort of lay the groundwork for Trump and the Tea Party.
I'm going to go back in a bit shortly to ask you about kind of what's happened to comedy and all the rest of it. But it's just like the way monsters are rehabilitated like that.
Yeah.
George Bush, really, really good example. The monstrous crimes in Iraq and all the rest of it. And then it was, he gave Michelle Obama a little sweet. Bless him. The classic one for me is always Theresa May, and everyone's now like, girl boss. It's like she appointed Boris Johnson foreign secretary. Everyone seems to erase that. But she also deported Black Britons en masse.
I mean,
it's a career based on scapegoating migrants. And now it's like, oh, Theresa May, decent prime minister in comparison.
They drove vans around areas with high density immigrant populations with signs on them saying, go home. You know, it sounds like an Onion headline. Like it was so incredibly toxic and racist. And I mean, she's a huge contributing factor to where we are as a country right now.
Because now she's occasionally made mild criticisms of a monster she helped create.
And also lemon and herb mild criticisms of the boss.
Yeah,
at least crank it up to medium, Teresa. No one's expecting Vusa extra hot, but crank it up to medium, for the love of God.
It's like, oh, the Rwanda plan might not be practical. Oh, right. Oh, she's searing.
I mean, Christ alive.
Andrew Neil, on the back of the, just back to the basketball, because Andrew Neil, I've had my run-ins with Andrew Neil, including on national television, where I challenged him about the fact he's the chair of The Spectator. The Spectator, turns out, also including The Spectator magazine's published articles supporting Greek Nazis, and it goes downhill from there. But he, when I challenged him on TV, the cameras went off. He started yelling, "I will deal with you. I deal with you." It's quite alarming. But he said once that the Mash report was self-satisfied, self-adulatory, unchallenged left-wing propaganda, and this was obvious. But it's just interesting, that, isn't it? Because he is somebody whose platform, he went on, founded GB News, which was an attempt to destroy the BBC, which didn't go very well, and then he ran away from it. Yeah, but I mean, that did show, didn't it, that if you're seen as being remotely and kind of critical of the status quo from the left, you're under this relentless pressure, which probably makes you, makes it quite difficult to do your job at the time. I don't know.
Well, it's, yeah, I think it just made everybody, it always made everybody quite jumpy at the BBC. You know, I should say, like, most of the people that work there are trying to make good shows. And, like, even things like the... even, like, when I did a radio show, there was one point where the lawyers, the actual compliance lawyers, would offer you alternatives. Like, they wouldn't say, you can't say that. They would say, you can't say that about these people. There was a high street banking chain, a well-known high street banking chain, that we were specifically told we couldn't say that they were laundering money for arms dealers, but we could say that they were laundering money for drug dealers. And the that was offered by the lawyers. You know, like, they were like, they sort of have this, you know, there is this interest in trying to not just shut down what you're saying, but there was an increasing tension. And it coincided with the show becoming more popular. You know, after we did four episodes in 2017, and they kind of appeared and disappeared. But in January 2018, that was when the clips from the show started going viral, and that was when there was a certain tension that began to creep in to some of the people around the show, and which seemed weird because you're like, sort of like, I thought we were supposed to do well. I thought it was a really deeply strange thing. There seemed to be a real heavy inference of, we actually preferred it when no one was watching this, to be honest with you. But it was, yeah, it was just a, yes, it is an interesting thing, and it is a very interesting media landscape, as you well know, to be saying anything somewhat left of center, because you're constantly told that you're on the side of the power in the media, and you're told that in the Telegraph, the Mail, the Sun, the Express, but you know, the Times a lot of the time, and the Spectator magazine, and the weight of that comes crashing down around you, and you realise actually there's very few left of center outlets in the media anymore. You know, it just doesn't exist. And you know, outside of The Guardian and The Mirror and The Independent, it just doesn't really exist. And the BBC is portrayed as a hotbed of leftist debauchery, but the BBC does a huge amount of work, and at times has overcompensated in terms of its search for balance.
I mean, it's interesting because also, to be honest, I just think, you know, right-wing comedy, there was an exception, by the way. I interviewed Jeff Norcott quite a while ago, actually. Yeah. I actually really like Jeff, and Jeff was on, obviously, on the Mash Report.
As yeah.
You. But in terms of funny right-wing comedians, I think even a lot of people on the right would concede that there's a dearth.
There's a dearth, and also, like, especially in terms of political comedy, if you want to have more political comedians that are on your side, get worse at winning elections. Like, it's been 12 years of a Tory government or a Tory majority coalition government. People are going to do comedy about the sitting, the majority of political comedy is going to act against the sitting government of the day. You know, like, you know, when we were growing up, you know, like, it's all of the satire was aimed at the government. And I don't remember at the time anyone saying, when will the thick of it have a dig at William Hague? You know, it's just such a strange thing. Like, political comedy naturally goes for whoever the sitting government of the day is.
I wonder, by the way, I mean, in terms of what happened to a lot of political comedy, or just comedy generally. I think going back, by the way, I won't ask you about this, but I think what happened after the Andrew Gilligan Today programme, in terms of that the New Labour went to the BBC at the time, basically, yeah, over the Iraq War. I mean, now Alistair Campbell's become, FPP, stop Brexit. But actually, I think made the BBC permanently more supine towards the government. But the other thing is, yeah, I wonder, did this incident have a lot to do with avoiding taking risks, basically? And it was the infamous Russell Brand, Jonathan Ross ringing. Who's that again?
Andrew Sachs. It was Andrew Sachs's granddaughter. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that had quite a lot to do with what happened afterwards, didn't it? In terms of the backlash.
I agree with you, but because it was a.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It was an incident that allowed people that had a problem with the BBC to go after the BBC. And, you know, it wasn't great. They, like, called up some, like, nice old man and talked about shagging his granddaughter. You're like, yeah, that wasn't great. But it was an excuse to sort of whack the BBC. And, like, I sort of remember at the time, it was front page news. And you sort of feel a bit like, I think everybody has lost perspective on this issue. You know, there was a civil war going on in Sudan at the time. And, like, people were just like, this Sachs, oh my God. And even to call it Sachs Gate, which is what we called it at the time, even to award it gate status is insane. What you're saying is this prank phone call is comparable to an attempt by the American president to spy on his political opposition. Like, it's like, okay, let's all take a breath. We've completely lost perspective on everything. That should have been a moment to just sort of take a breath and just kind of calm down. But that's what I always find interesting in these articles about is cancel culture killing free speech. We have the right to be, you know, offended, this, that, and the other. I remember a time where, you know, they you know, they were calling for their heads, you know, and Jonathan Ross did end up leaving the BBC over that issue. Mm-hmm. And whether you like the joke or not, either you believe in the principle of free speech or you don't. I mean, the one that I think is more serious was after the Chris Morris Brass Eyed Paedophile special.
I remember that.
It blew the tops off people's minds.
A paedophile has been spotted dressed as a school.
I mean, it's one of the
we
best.
We really need...
It's one of the best pieces of comedy of all time. The the thing where they, like, launch a paedophile into space.
That was the one thing. Because
the one thing we didn't want to happen. This is the one thing we didn't want to happen. It's an absolutely flawless, flawless piece of comedy.
Paedophiles have more in common with crabs than they do with you and I. There's no scientific evidence for it, but it is scientific fact.
It is genuinely sort of it. It is genuinely extraordinary. Like, but at the time, oh my God, people genuinely, like, lost their minds. There was so much anger and hostility around this issue. That's why I think I find some of the conversations about this sort of laughable now, because, you know, there's always been this sort of hysterical reaction to comedy, and it's not really a new conversation in a lot of ways.
David Smith wants to ask, nowadays we rightfully distinguish between punching up and punching down. At one point it seemed transgressive to joke about marginalised groups in an ironic way. However, was this a style of humour you embraced at the time, or have you always intended to punch up? Ooh, I love these big...
It's a big question. That's a big question. I think probably, like, at the start of my career, the style of comedy I was doing was just bad comedy, you know, as a lot of comedians are. Like, you know, when I started in 2008, you just sort of, you know, you do sort of, you just try anything. and you and definitely there's like this plenty of stand-up that I've done that is absolutely awful comedically and morally, and that that there was a vogue for that. Definitely, I know exactly the vogue that, you know, the first emergence of like Jimmy Carr as a stand-up, and not necessarily The Office as a sitcom, but the stand-up of Ricky Gervais certainly embraced that sort of, you know, I think there was this idea of like, if we've achieved a kind of broad liberal or leftist consensus that these forms of prejudice are incorrect, then joking about them in an ironic way can feel transgressive, but it only works as a joke because we have a shared set of social and cultural assumptions about what is and isn't acceptable. And the joke here is that the thing that I'm saying isn't acceptable. But I think, you know, very quickly what we realized is like, that there were people that were just laughing unironically. We're completely just, you know, having a great time, you know, enjoying the prejudice at face value. And
because I remember thinking that with Ricky, because I actually really liked, I remember as a teen, I was a teenager probably still, yeah, like Ricky Gervais's politics or whatever. But then after a while, it seems, it's like, am I, if this was just Bernard Manning saying these things?
Yeah, exactly.
The whole point, I mean, like, where does it become, oh, well, you know, I'm not being serious. I know I'm not being serious, but how far can that take us, I suppose?
Yeah, exactly. I think that that stuff just becomes much less funny as, you know, as it becomes, I think if your stand up is something that could legitimately have been said by Boris Johnson or Donald Trump, suddenly the comedy has been drained from it. And I think that's why you've maybe seen a shift away from that. You sort of over the course of the decade has shifted away from that style. I mean, there's always stand up that I have done that I'm not particularly impressed by and wouldn't have aged particularly well. But I don't think I could never really pull off stuff that was too mean. You know, even in an ironic way, I can never really pull that off with an audience. There's something about it that doesn't sit well with me. Like if I try and be sort of ironically cruel, it just seems cruel. You know, one of the things you sort of do as a comedian is you kind of learn, you try a bunch of stuff out and you see what fits for you. And for me, it just doesn't sit well with my comedic style. My attempts at cruelty just come off as mean. Like, this is good. Whatever twinkle in my eye I would need is not present.
I mean, I can't imagine that. I would just look at your face and go, it's fine. Cheers.
No, it is funny. It really does not work. It really, really does not work.
Just actually mean. Cancel culture. You mentioned cancel culture. It's a cliched question to ask a comedian, but I am a walking cliche, as detractors have noted at length. Yeah, cancel culture. I mean, you know, some people say, well, actually now, you know, people, even for mild transgressions, or by people making, maybe they're just trying to be a bit funny, poking a bit of fun at something,
yeah,
and then they are cancelled, quote unquote. What do you think about this whole concept?
I mean, I think it's a sort of, I think the idea that this is a bad time to do comedy is absolute nonsense. You know, because of the internet, it's created all of these platforms that and avenues for doing comedy. You know, there's, because of the streamers, because of podcasting, it's created this enormous global audience for comedy, and in a way that didn't really exist in the same way, you know, when I was growing up. You know, the Americans come over here in such volume, it's a completely different sort of state of affairs. You know, I can go and do shows in New York in like 100-seat theater and they will sell out, and I have almost no presence on American television. But because of podcasting and because of streaming, it's created a global comedy audience. So actually the idea that this is a bad time to do comedy is nonsense. This is in many ways the best possible time to do comedy, you know. And that's why I always find it deeply frustrating when someone like Joe Rogan mouths off about this being a bad time to do comedy. You would not have had a career before this. He's a bad comedian, but he certainly has something about him, whatever it is unclear. And the podcast market has created this huge audience for him, and you know, there's a lot of us that have really benefited from the internet as a transmission engine for our work. And, you know, speech has never been freer. You know, I could wake up and decide I want to tweet something, and I've just broadcast it to whatever it is, like 400,000 people or something. You know, it's, you know, but you can't, what you can't do is say the audience weren't laughing and that's cancel culture. Mm-hmm. You know, what you, the thing about stand-up is that ultimately the audience is going to tell you what's funny and what's not funny. And if they don't find something funny, there is a good chance you've not done your job well enough. But the problem is that in my personal experience of people that I know that have really embraced this school of thought, I knew them as open mic comedians and they were bad comedians. We were all bad comedians. Some of us thought maybe I should be less bad. These guys thought, no, I'll plow on with this being a bad comedian thing. Then one day they read a Jordan Peterson book and were like, it wasn't our fault. It was women and immigrants. And now they sort of have got careers off the back of this kind of, you know, off this idea that, you know, they've made careers out of the idea that you can't say anything anymore.
Yeah, I mean, if you say you've been cancelled, that's a great way of getting a...
phenomenal way of kickstarting an ailing career.
Because you get the I've been cancelled tour, for a start.
You get the I've been cancelled tour, you get the supportive articles being written about you in the Express and the Mail, and suddenly a bad comedian has become a sort of low-level media celebrity.
Yeah, and I always think if cancel culture is a thing, then Louis C.K., whatever people think about...
Louis C.K. won a Grammy. You know, there's no need to allegedly or any of this stuff. He admitted to doing the things he's done, and so you know what. To what extent are we? What are we talking about here anymore? You know, it's. I'm not sure what the conversation is about. It just seems to be a spurious excuse that bad comedians use because people aren't laughing at their jokes.
You get this sometimes with journalists, which is they've joined social media because they thought basically everyone would just shower them with praise and their peers would appreciate them. And then when people gave them feedback they didn't appreciate, they got a bit angry about it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. 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 It's, I mean, social media in a sense, you know, the kind of short form of it does encourage things to get a bit more blunt than they might be if you were just having a normal conversation with people. And that, I think, is an issue. I think that's why, that's what leads to some of the debate maybe feeling a bit more fractious than it might. But I do think that, like, I do think you do need to draw a distinction between somebody just going, you're a fucking piece of shit, and somebody saying, I do have an issue with some of those things, and here is the issue, and I will articulate that issue clearly and substantiate it. That's not cancel culture. That's just be, and equally, if you're a comedian and you tank a gig, you can't scream that was cancel culture. You just need to work on your jokes more. I'm sorry. Back to the drawing board.
You mentioned the thick of it before. I'm interested in that as well, in terms of what's happened, because obviously, as you know, satire is generally aimed at the ruling government. It's the whole point is you're taking on the powerful. That's the point.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wonder with the thick of it, that if you watch the thick of it now, I haven't watched it for a long time, to be fair, but I'm not sure it would. I think it's kind of been overtaken by events, because the kind of wackiness and absurdity of the last few years, doesn't it make satire? I mean, Tom Lehrer, the American satirist, when Henry Kissinger was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, he was like, I'm out.
Do
you know what I mean? Like, have things just become so just, you know, now we've got to the point where it's hard to be shocked by anything that happens anymore.
Well, what I would say with the thick of it is that, I haven't seen the TV show in a long time, but I very recently rewatched In the Loop. And In the Loop really, really stands up. It's the film that was, it was a kind of filmed spin-off of The Thick of It. And it really holds up brilliantly as a satire of the lead up to the war in Iraq. And there are actually not that many films that successfully engage, especially when you compare it to the sort of cinematic output around the Vietnam War, it holds up really well. And there were not a lot of movies that attempted to really engage with the war. I mean, that's, it's interesting that you sort of circle back to Vice again, because that obviously deals with it in a big chunk. But I thought it held up really well. I think the issue with The Thick of It is, A, I think the comedy is perfect. And so you can just watch it as a workplace sitcom. I think that it's so well written and so well executed. I think the comedy in The Thick of It, though, I would say is predicated on the understanding that a group of people cared intently about the way the public saw them. And their fragility is all based on the fact that they're constantly consumed with perception and the illusion of not making any mistakes. Whereas now the idea of politics seems to be to make mistakes almost deliberately. And the idea now almost, it's the opposite end. It's if you admit to a mistake, that's fallibility. You know, I mean, we're recording this the day after Boris Johnson sort of refused to walk back or apologise for any of his remarks that he made about the Archbishop of Canterbury's comments about the Rwanda plan for asylum seekers. And that is very much his style. I mean, he essentially repeated a far right-wing smear about Keir Starmer failing to prosecute Jimmy Savile, which is straight off far right-wing online message boards. And he refused to apologize for that. And I think the thing with the politicians in The Thick of It and the New Labour era that it was satirizing was it was about a group of people who were so consumed by not making a mistake that they actually ended up not doing anything. Whereas at the moment, the attitude is very much just go minute to minute, scandal to scandal. And as long as you do enough things wrong, the public will almost become exhausted. I mean, if you look, you know, there was a piece in The Guardian about the first 1,000 days of the Johnson era as prime minister. And it was an attempt to catalogue all of the scandals. And I completely sympathise. Not everybody is as sadomasochistic as you and me, and would be fixated on, you know, like all like studying the details of what's going on. And if you were less inclined to do that, you can understand why people would go, I just can't engage with it anymore. Like, there's so many scandals that I just can't even engage with it.
I mean, just a couple of final things. I mean, when we talk about cancel culture and what we're talking about there, often, let's be honest, is a lot of white men saying things which you could read in any mainstream newspaper, like the Daily Mail or the Sun, or repeated by the Prime Minister, or, for example, the former President of the United States, the most powerful person on the world. But
I don't think that once you've elected, you know, a man who's casually used, you know, we're allowed to call Boris Johnson racist on the BBC. We were allowed to do that because he has used racial epithets in newspaper columns. Like, we were literally allowed to say that man is a racist. And once you've elected that man prime minister of your country, then what the hell are we talking about anymore?
But when you as a person of color speak about racism, you get inundated, obviously, with often violent, vitriolic, horrific racism. I mean, does it not feel like being gaslit that you get, for example, lots of white men saying things which actually are said by the most powerful people in the country with no consequences, as you noted? But and that scene is like, wow, 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 they're being cancelled, they're a victim. And then you talk about the existence of racism as an established fact, as a lived experience, and you don't obviously get coverage of the sorts of like racist abuse you're subjected to on social media and elsewhere.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is at points very frustrating. You know, it is at points very, it can make you very angry. But I guess the thing that you have to accept that this is where the power balance is in the country at the moment. You know, that this is, that the interests of the kind of machinery that controls the media is skewed in a certain political direction. And there are, you know, the people that own these newspapers have a particular agenda to service. And you understand that actually those readers aren't, you know, those proprietors are not going to really give over too many column inches to racism, because they are themselves racist, or they are, you know, they are people that are simply interested in paying less income tax and not willing to turn a blind eye to racism if the political party in power is going to deliver them their tax cuts. One is not better than the other, I'm afraid. And so you do sort of have to accept that reality and then, you know, sort of just crack on, push on regardless. And you do sort of have to accept that, like, that's, you know, that's just where the country is at the moment. You know, this is Boris Johnson's country, and the fight to turn it round from Boris Johnson's country is not going to be straightforward, but the options are basically, you know, push through or give up at this point.
Finally, what we like to do, what I often like to do, is we'll take the scenic tour to a kind of moment of hope and optimism.
Yeah.
We have to work with the material we've got, which is not ample in the world. But what gives you kind of a sense of hope, of optimism? What makes you think, in this world of looking around of a lot of shit?
Yeah.
What you're just sifting through the shit. Yeah. Lovely image for everyone. What's the hope? What's the optimism? What makes you think, maybe things are all right?
Well, I think the engagement of the younger generation with politics is really interesting. And I think the school strikes and what Greta Thunberg's managed to achieve is pretty extraordinary in terms of taking an issue that has always been, you know, marginalized. And it's mad because the issue is we're all going to die. But I think that, like, the engagement of that generation with that issue of the climate crisis is absolutely incredible. I also think, and this is a real circular route to it, the thing that I draw optimism from at the moment is that a lot of these political parties that come to power or win power, so the US Republicans might have lost the election, but they reshaped the Supreme Court, and the first thing that all of these governments are doing is trying to clamp down actively on dissent. You know, the Conservative government is pushing through a police and crime bill that would allow the police to set the appropriate volume on protests, you know, which is obviously absurd. They're threatening an election ID bill to solve the non-existent problem of voter fraud. So the thing that the kernel of optimism I hold on to is they must be afraid of us, the people, in some way. They must be concerned. And, you know, these are governments that essentially keep winning elections based on the strange and arcane electoral systems in this country. You know, it's a country of, it's a country of minority rule. And so I have to believe that they are afraid of the power that is contained within the populations of this country. And so I believe if they're afraid, then that we can play on that fear and turn the situation around. If there must be a reason that they're trying to restrict election access. There must be a reason that they're trying to sort of clamp down a protest. And I think that reason is they're worried that their supporters are getting older, they're unable to attract younger voters, and that they fear that without some sort of external intervention, they might not be able to win elections for much more. And that's what I feel optimistic about.
I feel much more optimistic already. Things are going to be fine in the end.
It's all going to be fine. It'll all come out of the wash.
Are you on tour at the moment?
Big time, baby.
Nish is on tour. Do look up, obviously,
nishkumar.co.uk.
Easy. Come on. Do that now. Immediately. This is going to take you a second, so why wouldn't you do it? Nish, what an absolute honour and pleasure.
The honour and pleasure was all mine, Owen.
Lots of love.
Nice to be there with the only person on the internet people are angrier with than me.
Sometimes I don't even know I'm trending.
I should have just popped a picture of Ash up behind me and we could have had the full unholy trifecta.
Yeah. Oh, dear. We really do live in their heads. but lots of love, Nish. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting, and I certainly did. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road, /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars, that'd be nice. Spread the word. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.